Now, I'm starting with something that was said during one of our board meetings of the society. This is by email and phone usually. And I made the observation that the society is dominated by physical scientists. Now, Steve Barr tries very hard to be fair-minded, is very fair-minded. I think he was a little concerned about that. But as I hope I explained successfully to him, this was not meant as a criticism of the Society of Catholic Scientists. It was a criticism of the larger society, and in particular, the Society of Biological Scientists. There are many polls that show that the majority of scientists, but especially biological scientists, are either atheists or agnostic. Not quite as much the case for physical sciences, but why is that the case? Partly, this is historical. There's some bad blood. Part of it is deserved, caused by suppression of the teaching of evolution. But I think that's only part of the answer, and it doesn't quite explain the implacable and blanket hostility of some biologists against any and all religions. This has become something of a habit for us, but what is this really about? I like to say somewhat mordantly that biologists do not believe in the existence of life. Of course they do, but they don't think much about what is meant by the term like life, except in medical and other ethics when it becomes a matter of mostly procedural terms. So a lot of the debate really is about vitalism. The battleground for biology, other than evolution, has been vitalism. Vitalism is dead. But, as I like to say, if it's dead, it died an uneasy death, and its ghost may walk the night. It's not entirely dead. And the problem is that we seem to need terms like life, like mind, like soul, or anima, or psyche in Greek. I'm going to say a few words about vitalism. And when I first took my biochemistry course, and the professor gave the perfunctory 30 seconds on the history of science, he mentioned that there was a time not so long ago when people just didn't believe that enzymes did ordinary chemistry. And of course, that is a debate that is over. Enzymes, though very, very efficient, are catalysts. And they do fundamentally the same kind of chemistry that occurs elsewhere in the universe, at least as far as we know. Now, one of the beginning of the end of vitalism, scientific vitalism, we can date that, we can say it's a vital date, was 1828 when Friedrich Wöhler synthesized a so-called living compound, namely urea. I'll mention there's a related compound called hippuric acid, which is a very stable compound. Now, at 3 in the morning, you're going to find out that that was a hilarious joke. Think about that one. Hippuric acid. Okay. Anyway, Wöhler synthesized urea from inorganic compounds. Now, the final nail in the coffin of scientific vitalism was from Edward No Umlaut Büchner. These are his dates. He was a German chemist and zymologist. We would now call him enzymologist. He was a Nobel laureate in chemistry, and he showed that a cell-free extract of yeast cells, what he called press juice, could ferment sugar. No cells were required. And this was a crushing blow to vitalism. There is, by the way, the other Büchner, who is Ernst Umlaut Büchner, and he's the one industrial chemist for whom the Büchner funnel and flask were named. Okay, now, during the 19th century, there was the maturation of biology as a science, the beginning of it, and that was the development of the cell theory. Matthias Schleiden used microscopy, and he showed that all plant tissues are made up of cells, the basic building blocks of all cells. And he also showed that plant embryos emerged from a single cell and grew by cell replication, cell division. Now, in the animal world, Schwann showed a similar thing for animal cells. He showed that animal tissues like cartilage, like plants, are made up of cells, and animals grow and develop by cell division. He also studied fermentation, and he strongly argued, he was very much against vitalism. He was a foe of vitalism. Why explain biology with some mysterious life force when ordinary chemistry and physics would suffice? And so he was against any kind of vitalism. Now, of course, the biggest name in the study of fermentation in the 19th century was Louis Pasteur. He studied many things, was a great, great scientist, of course, studied vaccination, developed a vaccine against anthrax, developed germ theory. He discovered the chirality of organic compounds, optical activity. But he studied fermentation, and he concluded that it could only be carried out by living cells. This was a form of vitalism. And he may have been the last great scientific vitalist. Now, I want to consider for a moment, why did he come to this conclusion when Schwann, operating with very similar data, came to the opposite conclusion? Why was that the case? Well, in part, he was settling a debate from the previous century between John Needham and Lazzaro Spallanzani. Needham believed that organisms grew in broth because a nutrient contains some kind of vital power. And what Spallanzani did was to heat the broth. Well, first, Needham heated the broth, but very briefly, and showed that organisms then grew out in that. Now, Spallanzani heated the broth longer, as we now know, killing all the organisms. And then he sealed it, and no organisms regrew. Now, Needham argued that Spallanzani had destroyed the vegetative power of the broth and the air that was sealed in the flask by the extensive heating. So what Pasteur did, which was both against spontaneous generation and in support of the germ theory, was he invented the famous swan neck flask, which is shown here. If you heat and let it sit, no bacteria or other organisms will grow. If you break off the neck of the flask, making no change in either the air or the broth, the bacteria will grow. The swan's neck prevented the entry of organisms into the broth. So Louis Pasteur's, this was a pasteurization experiment, as we would now call it. It illustrates the fact that the spoilage of liquid by microorganisms was caused by particles in the air that were blocked out by the swan's neck, and they were important. This was important evidence in support of the germ theory of disease. Now, what's the current status? Now, I'm going to date myself a little bit here by making a play on an ancient TV show. The name will be changed to Protect the Guilty. This is something I found on the web, and there's many, many more like it. More offensive to me as a physician is the idea of vitalism. This ancient principle says that the difference between living and non-living things is some sort of non-material vital force. As the natural philosophers of the last few centuries became more sophisticated, they worked with this assumption and tried to define it scientifically. My comment. Sophisticated, is that the only thing that's changed? I don't really think so. I think the problem here is that this is just a declaration of dislike of vitalism. It's not actually an argument. Okay, so I'm going to give three arguments about vitalism. And then I'm going to move on to one theory of vitalism, which is that of Henri Bergson. So the first thing to say about wrong with vitalism is that it's a negative statement. It tries to prove a negative, which is extremely difficult to do. Some forms of vitalism, they really basically say what science can't do. And not only don't we know, but even if we did know, it would be hard to prove. What it can't define in life. It may be the case that, that's true. There are some philosophical, not scientific reasons against the something like a life force. But to say that there are life processes that cannot be accounted for by ordinary chemistry and physics has proven in the past to be a very dangerous thing to say. Those are very famous last words, as they were for Pasteur. The problem, I think, is a logical one, trying to prove what cannot happen, trying to prove a negative, trying to prove what doesn't exist, what will never happen, is very, very difficult, if not impossible. It's something like saying that black swans don't exist until, of course, they do. And they do. Okay. Second problem is that vitalism seems to be contentless. To a scientist, I'm talking about scientific vitalism here, a force is a force only if it can be measured. And we might say by analogy that if a tree falls in the forest and no one hears it, yes, the molecules of air have vibrated, but there's no sound. Okay, so as I said, the example of vitalism that I'm going to mention is on that of Henri Bergson, who created, coined the term élan vital in his book, Creative Evolution. Now, the problem is that this is to call this a life force is maybe a bit of a mistranslation, but it's probably more like a life impulse. This idea has been criticized, for example, by Julian Huxley, grandson of Darwin's bulldog, Thomas Huxley, who said this, to say that biological progress is explained by the élan vital is to say that the movement of a train is explained, in scare quotes, by an élan locomotif, or of the engine. Now, another example of the potential contentlessness of élan vital is from Molière's play Le Malade Imaginaire, the Hypochondriac. There's something I identify with, which is the giving of a diploma to a medical doctor. And I went through it, and it was not exactly like this. But here's this macaronic Latin-French combination that is essentially untranslatable. This is a picture by Daumier of the imaginary, the invalid. And of course, since it's untranslatable, I'm going to translate it. You ask the cause and the reason that opium produces sleep, to which I answer that it has a dormitive power whose nature puts the senses to sleep. I mean, that says nothing. That's the point, okay? Now, the third problem with life force or élan vital, however you want to translate it, is that it seems at first like a category error. Because it seems to dress up a formal and final cause as if it were a material and efficient cause. And here I give a fine example of that. This is in 1907. Dr. Duncan McDougall of Haverhill, Massachusetts, proposed to measure the weight of the human soul. What he did was he took patients who were dying of tuberculosis and he suspended their bed on a sensitive scale. And as they gave up the ghost, he measured the weight of the ghost. And that was the weight of the soul, okay? How much weight did they lose? Now, he got pilloried, absolutely pilloried in the press for bad science, and he deserved every bit of it. However, the bad science was the least of his problems. The biggest problem was bad metaphysics, because he mistook a formal cause for a material and efficient cause. Okay, So now we come to Elan Vital. I think the other problem that we have with life with Elan Vital is that might not necessarily be the concept itself, but the tendency in some quarters to junk it up, make it cheesy, and plus the fact that calling it a life force is a bit of a mistranslation. It's a little bit untranslatable, Elan Vital, but I'll pass that by. Okay, so what did Bergson actually say? Here's my 46-second summary of what Bergson said about Elan Vital. Life originated as a result of some impulse or force, Elan, that is common to all living things. He called this Elan Vital. And there is also, that's one thing that animates all living things. And there is also a principle of diversion and differentiation. And this accounts for the fact that we don't have one living thing, we have diversity of living things. Now these two impulses or principles or forces, he identified with instinct and intelligence respectively. Human knowledge comes from the latter, intelligence, and the intelligence is inherently analytical. It's external to life itself, and it takes a practical and spatialized approach to the world. On the other hand, instinct, not intelligence, can attain to the essence of life, at least for the duration of this life. And intuition and imagination allow us to get back to the creative impulse. This is, by the way, very much tied. You may know Bergson for his theory of laughter. This is one of the things he said about laughter, is that it occurs when we get too far from Elan Vital and our ideas become mechanized. And in that respect, think of Charlie Chaplin, literally, not just figuratively, in the machine in City Lights. That's the kind of thing that I think Bergson was talking about in his theory of laughter. Okay, so what is Elan Vital? Probably not exactly an efficient or material cause, probably something a little more like a formal or possibly final cause. So I think it's a mistake to ask this force, despite calling it a force, if that's what we want to call it, it's a mistake to ask a formal cause to do the work of an efficient cause. I think that's problematic. Now, just to review, I think you all know this, and you've heard about this from other speakers, including Father Thomas. There are the four Aristotelian causes. He didn't give them the names. It was other editors who did. The formal cause, since I'll be talking more about that, ta ti ein anai means literally what the thing was to be. I love it, it's a gerundive. As we might also say, what the thing was meant to be, or more simply, what the thing is. There are a couple of key points about this. If you read Aristotle's words, what he says is there are four ways of speaking about cause, aetion. Or etion, plural. So I take his point to be fundamentally linguistic. How do we talk to each other and understand about causality? So understanding, to Aristotle, was very much of a societal thing. Man is, after all, a political animal. So he saw the four ways of talking about cause as just that. And, second important point, the causes are interrelated. It doesn't make sense to talk about only one of the causes. This is the problem, as I will say a few different ways, this is one of the problems of science. It focuses almost exclusively on efficient and material causes and only reluctantly or not at all talks about the others. So words like species or form are very problematic in modern science, as we know, has been pointed out in other sessions. They were problematic before modern science, but they're especially problematic now. But I think, I'm not gonna solve the problems, but I think we should at least start by trying to be conscientious about which use of aetion we really mean when we're talking about one or the other. We shouldn't mean a formal cause when we're talking about an efficient cause, and vice versa. Thomas Aquinas, as I think you probably all know this, saw the soul as the form of the living being. He said, when talking about life, we can talk about all the different causes, and in talking about the soul, like life, I think it's words that we still need, he started addressing the question of what the soul is in much the same way, a completely parallel way to how we began to discuss God. He asked whether God is a body. Whether God is a body. Now, note, when Thomas used the word body, that's not the same as our modern use of the word matter. It's a very different word. By body, he meant roughly something that has three dimensions, is extended in space. Now, here, he sided with Aristotle against the older philosophers, the so-called antiqui, in saying that souls, whatever they are not bodies, cannot be bodies. Why did he say that? He said the philosophers of old, the antiqui, not being able to rise above their imagination, supposed that the principle of these actions, life, was something corporeal. For they asserted that only bodies were real things and that what is not corporeal is nothing. Hence they maintained that the soul is something corporeal. Some said it was water, others said it was air, others said it was fire, or different combinations of all those things. But his main argument is this. Therefore, a body is competent to be a living thing or a principle of life as such a body. You take a cadaver and a living body, what's the difference? One is alive and one is dead. Tale, such a body. A living body is a body of a particular kind. Therefore, being a body per se is not sufficient for soulness, for being a soul. It owes the first principle of life not to the body per se, but to the act of a body. And here's something that biologists just hate. When you start talking about the soul to a biologist, they either hit you or run away or something like that. But I don't think they really understand how little this definition says. I mean, it says a lot, but in another way, it says very little. It says that the anima, the soul, is what makes us animata, alive. The problem is English. Life is much easier in Latin. In English, the word soul has no cognate. It may just be the closest in German, Seele, which means a lake or an ocean or something. But to say that anima, soul, is what makes us animata, alive, doesn't explain really a whole lot in many ways, certainly not in the ways that scientists think about it. And Thomas also said that the soul is simple in comparison with the body inasmuch as it does not occupy space by its bulk. It's not a body, it's a simple substance, is what he said. Cannot be divided. A body in three dimensions can be divided, the soul cannot. Okay, so I warned some of you that this was coming. Much liberal quotation of James Joyce shown here. This is in chapter 9 of Ulysses. Stephen Dedalus is in the National Library in Dublin. He is explaining his theory of Shakespeare to the four librarians in the Dublin Library. And in sort of in an entr'acte in his exposition of the Shakespeare theory, he has this interior monologue. By the way, it's not stream of consciousness. Joyce called it interior monologue, not stream of consciousness. So here we're inside the head of Stephen Dedalus, and he's thinking about something in conversation with himself that is peppered with Elizabethan Shakespearean idiom. So he says, "How now, sirrah? That pound he lent you when you were hungry." The he in this question is A.E. That's the pen name for George Russell, the poet, who was one of the librarians listening to Stephen Shakespeare theory. "Marry, I wanted it. Take thou this noble. Go to. You spent most of it in Georgina Johnson's bed, clergyman's daughter, Agenbite of Inwit. Do you intend to pay it back? Oh, yes. When? Now? Well, no. When then? I paid my way. Steady on. He's from beyond Boyne Water, the northeast corner. You owe it. Wait. Five months. Molecules all change. I am Other Eye now. Other Eye, dot pound. Buzz, buzz. But I, Intellikey, form of forms, am I by memory, because under ever-changing forms. I that sinned and prayed and fasted, a child con me saved from pandies, I, A-E-I-O-U. Now, this is an execrable pun. All good puns are execrable. Now I'm going to explain what I think this means. So Stephen Dedalus, like James Joyce, was completely irresponsible with money. And he borrowed, he was also poor. But he borrowed a pound from A.E., George Russell, claiming hunger. But instead of spending it on food, he spent it on his favorite prostitute, Georgina Johnson. And for that, he has agenbite of inwit, which is a Kentish English term for remorse of conscience. He feels bad. So he asks himself, are you going to pay it back? And he says, yeah, but not now. And then he thinks, I paid my way. Now, those are the words of his employer, who is an orange man and not to be trusted. As he says, he's from beyond Boyne Water, the north of Ireland, okay, the northeast corner. And, you know, he says, Mr. Deasy, my employer, would say I owe it. But then he comes up with this great stratagem. He says, wait, 5 months, molecules all change. I am Other Eye now. Other Eye got pound. But then he thinks, that's not going to work. Why not? Because I, Intellikey, the Aristotelian term, am I by memory, because under ever-changing forms. He's playing with the word form. Lowercase f is the changing appearances. Intellikey, I will say, is uppercase f. It is the form of forms, the underlying form that goes underneath all the changing appearances. So the molecules may change, but there's something ontologically in him that does not, and he knows that because he has memory of himself as a child that sinned and prayed and fasted, and that Father Conley, in Portrait of the Artist, Joyce is so self-referential, he refers to his own other books in his books. A child Conley saved from Pandy. There are all these different versions of I, but they all add up to I. And the important point here, the punchline is, not just a pun, but having a united sense of self leads to ethics. I do owe you. I can't use this ruse of the other molecules changing. Okay. Now, there's another character in the novel, Leopold Bloom, the other main character, Leopold, one of the others, who has a very different view of the human being. And this is, he attends a funeral of one Patty Dignam in episode 6. And he's looking around at all the graves and he's thinking about the dead bodies. And he thinks this to himself, interior monologue. A pump, after all, pumping thousands of gallons of blood every day. One fine day, it gets bunged up and there you are. Lots of them lying around here. Lungs, hearts, livers, old rusty pumps. Damn the thing else. Once you're dead, you're dead. Now, I have no quarrel with the idea that the heart is a pump, but where I object, where I differ, is where he says, damn the thing else, that that's all there is. And that's where he has a very different view from Stephen Dedalus. Now, this idea about the molecules all changing, this is, I think, when Stephen Dedalus thinks molecules all change, I am Other Eye now, Other Eye got pound. This is really, Derek Parfit's thought experiment about the cells of Greta Garbo that you heard about from Professor Carroll, These are both variants of an ancient philosophical quandary, which is Theseus's ship. And here's a bit of a quote from Plutarch. The ship wherein Theseus and the youth of Athens returned from Crete had 30 oars and was preserved. For they took away the old planks as they decayed, putting in new and stronger timbers in the place. And then the philosophers debated, does the ship remain the same ship or not? And that's the fundamental question. Now, there's a second version of this, which is added by Hobbes, the same of Leviathan. If the original planks were gathered up and used to build a second ship, which ship, would be the ship of Perseus? Now, of course, a lot of potential solutions, have been proposed for this question. And I think they're all really variants of the question, what makes a thing to be what it is? Or what is the essence of a thing? What is the form of a thing? I'm going to give an Aristotelian answer that would consider the four causes. The material cause of the ship is really what has changed. The final cause presumably has remained about the same. The ship still functions as a ship. Likewise, the techniques used to put in the original planks are probably pretty much the same as were used to put in the first planks. So the efficient cause hasn't changed. What's really changed is the formal cause. What has not changed is the formal cause. The form or design of the ship remains the same, even though the matter used to construct the ship has changed. Now, the problem is biology. Biology is what causes a fly in this nice ointment. There's this very amusing novel that was made into a movie with Tony Randall, believe it or not. And one of the characters is not a major character, but he's the lawyer Frank Tull. And he is described by Charles Finney, the author, as a man of many artificial parts. He had bifocals, false teeth, a plate in his skull, prosthetic leg of metal and fibers, a platinum wire replacing his humerus. He receives weekly injections of mercury or salversan. Does anyone know what that's for? Okay, I'll tell you later. But today, he might have a kidney transplant, a bone marrow transplant, a liver transplant, a heart transplant, even a brain transplant. And would he be the same person? By the way, at dinner, someone asked me to tell you a great joke about brain transplants. Okay, the point is that here we get a more complicated, maybe qualitatively different version of the ship of Theseus problem. Because it's not just parts, it's artificial parts, transplant parts, novel species, hybrid species, real chimera, real artificial species. What about artificial intelligence? These pose very serious problems for our understanding of what a species is and what a form is. I'm not saying they're insurmountable, but they pose problems. Okay, so now I'm going to listen to my wife, and I'm going to skip all the stuff on the mind-body problem. And this is a philosophy movie. If you see something you want to ask about, we can talk about it later. Okay, so we'll pick it up here. So in Thomas, in talking about the human soul, I think, you know, the problem with hylomorphism, not a problem, but maybe where it doesn't go quite far enough, is that it doesn't really explain the difference between human beings and other animals. I mean, other animals are subject to the same hylomorphic principles as human beings. But what's the difference between a human being and another animal? And Thomas Aquinas said that the human soul is special. It's a rational soul. And he said that the human soul is the highest and noblest of forms. Wherefore, it excels corporeal manner, matter in its power by the fact that it has an operation and a power in which corporeal matter has no share whatever. This power is called the intellect. So this is Thomas's famous or infamous notion that the intellect, it does not have a corporeal organ. And this is what he says here. I'm not going to take the time to read it, but he had an argument which has been taken to task, and I'm not going to go into it and to spend the time to go into it. It would be very interesting, but we have to move on. Now, one of the questions when I first read this was, what did Thomas know about the brain? Did he know anything about the brain? Or did he think perhaps that the mind was somewhere else or nowhere else? And just to settle that particular point, he did know about the brain. He learned about it from, among others, the great Persian Arabic natural philosopher Ibn Sina, whom he referred to as Avicenna in Latin. And Avicenna described a pathway from the external senses to the intellect, which seemed to occur through the flow of fluids through different chambers of the brain, what we now call the ventricles. What do we do with neuroscience? And here's a lovely creature, which is 1962, Eric Kandel did a residency in psychiatry, as did Alois Alzheimer, by the way. And then he went to Paris and he studied the marine mollusk Aplysia, which is shown here. And what he realized is that simple life forms can teach us a great deal about our complicated brain. They have mental phenomena of a sort, like sensitization, classical conditioning, operant conditioning. And he studied, here's the nice little mollusk, and he studied the ganglion of the mollusk, which is dissected out here, the central ganglia, which is kind of a brain, if you will. Thomas Aquinas, by the way, also knew of the brain from his sometime mentor, Albertus Magnus, who had a somewhat different conception of the brain from Ibn Sina. Okay, so here's the question. Why did Thomas think that the intellect did not have a corporeal organ? Kandel and many, many others since then have shown neurological events and neuronal events occurring as creatures learn. Yes, the mollusk, but also human beings at this point. Now, I would argue that Thomas's statements about the intellect should not be interpreted primarily about neurological sciences. Rather, I would say these are philosophical statements about what should and shouldn't be called intellect. The final cause of intellect, as Thomas describes it, is knowledge, and in particular, the knowledge of essences of universal, and these are incorporeal. So we know dogs, to use my favorite example, or stones, the example that Thomas always used, because we have abstracted the essence of dogginess or stoniness, but and those are incorporeal. But it's more than that. So far, what I've said is just a variant of Aristotelian hylomorphism. It could describe what any animal does in negotiating the world. For Thomas, the rational soul was also a way of knowing and inferring certain things about the existence of God and other abstractions and incorporeal things. So our question now is, how far back does thought go? Now, when Thomas talked about animals, he used this blanket term, brute animals, including all animals. As a dog lover, I prefer to talk about E. coli and C. elegans and the like. And I think the question was, where was knowledge before there were human beings? Did it exist? Do E. coli think? Did the post-Big Bang plasma think? Now, you may know that there's this book by Thomas Nagel And I would say, and in it, he makes an interesting argument. I think some people sometimes get the right answer for a wrong reason. So here's my example of getting the right answer for a wrong reason. I was taught this in my math class, which is why I became a biologist, not a physicist. So you take a number like 19/95, and you cross out the nines, and lo and behold, you get the right answer, 1/5. So it's possible to get the right answer for the wrong reason. I would say that Thomas Nagel got the wrong answer for the right reason. And he argues that thought and value are real features of the world, not just byproducts or projections of subjectivity or desires. And this is a quote from Edward Fesser, who is going to be keynote speaker at the society meeting. I'm very much looking forward. But as he points out, this is an Aristotelian thesis. I would add that it's also a Thomistic thesis. And this would probably not please Mr. Nagel to hear, because inexplicitly, to me at least, in the last pages of the book, he outs himself as an atheist. And I don't know how he comes to that conclusion, but he does. Okay, but we'll leave that as it is. We'll go back to... See, working with two computers, I'm not clever enough. Okay, so one of Molly Bloom's complaints about... I gave you the quote from Leopold Bloom before. One of her complaints, the last chapter, episode 18 in Ulysses, is Molly lying in bed, thinking in incredibly long, run-on sentences. It's the most gorgeous prose I think I've ever read. But anyway, one of the things that she complains about her husband is that he's an atheist. Because he never goes to church, mass, or meeting, he says, "Your soul, you have no soul inside you, only gray matter." And that may sound like what some people have said in recent times, because he doesn't know what it is to have one. Right. And I'm going to just read a little bit of this. He says, "I wouldn't give, as for them saying there's no God, I wouldn't give a snap of my two fingers for all their learning. Why don't they go and create something?" I often ask them, atheists, or whatever they call themselves, go and wash the cobbles off themselves first. Then they go howling for the priest, and they're dying. Why? Because they're afraid of hell on account of their bad conscience. Ah, yes, I know them well. Who was the first person in the universe before there was anybody that made it all? Who? Ah, that they don't know. Neither do I. So there you are. So Molly, not being a theologian or a philosopher, still has a sense of the ontological necessity for a creator. There are many problems. To conclude on a few points, there are many, many problems with ideas like form and species. If you ask any evolutionary biologist, what is a species, you're more likely to get a dirty look than an answer. Yet, they need the word, and in fact, use it all the time. If you ask any biological scientist about final cause or teleology, you're likely to be sworn at or hit. And yet, they describe to the idea of normalcy in physiological function. They know that a heart is a kind of pump. And when evolutionary biologists speak routinely of the survival instinct, whether they realize it or not, they are being teleological. And indeed, Thomas Henry Huxley, grandfather of Julian and Darwin's bulldog, actually praised Darwin, Darwin's Origin of Species, for bringing teleology into biology. So we need these terms, life, mind, soul. We can't just explain them away. We need them even as biologists. We have our work cut out for us right now, trying to define them in terms that are consistent, compatible with modern biological science. Now, coming back to this quote from Stephen Dedalus. When he says, I am I by memory, this is not a purely Lockean view, because he's also speaking in terms of ontology by bringing entelechy into it. I think it's also Stephen Dedalus trying to make a narrative, which Dedalus, as a nascent artist, is always trying to do. But I think one of the main points in Ulysses is the universality of this process. Even Leopold Bloom, as one of the characters' remarks of him, has a touch of the artist about him, as one of the characters says. Now, why does it all matter? I think why I like to think about this whole mind-body problem, have been thinking about it, why it matters, is that without form, without the soul, that is, it's very difficult to define personhood. And without personhood, it's very difficult, if not impossible, for there to be morality. And I think it raises the question, why should a machine care what is done unto others? I raise this as a question. My guess is that a machine doesn't care. It's an open question. It's possible that a sufficiently complex machine would care, though I rather doubt it. But I think that's what's at stake here. That's why it matters. Now, when I'm not thinking about James Joyce, which is about 30 minutes between 2 and 3 in the afternoon, I think about Alzheimer's disease and beta amyloid. And this is a normal brain on top. It's normal except for the fact that it's outside of a head. Alzheimer's disease brain, you can see how shrunken it is. It's lost a lot of neurons. And now we're going to make a sagittal cut through this area here and see what it looks like. Here are the ventricles, these big holes in the center, which are way too large. Sagittal section of a patient with Alzheimer's disease. And these are the lesions defined by Alois Alzheimer in 1906. On the left is the neuritic plaque, which contains that protein beta amyloid that I studied. On the right is a neurofibrillary tangle that contains another aggregating protein called tau. We call people who study tau, we call them Taoists. This is some work from about, good grief, more than 20 years ago, in which we used solid state NMR to define the fundamental structure of beta amyloid fibrils, which is the parallel in registered beta sheet. But what I'd like to say is that the molecules, however fascinating, should not allow us to forget this, which is the human face of Alzheimer's disease. This is a patient named Augusta D. This is the patient that Alois Alzheimer interviewed, studied for 5 years until she died. And I think she has a forlorn expression on her face because she really doesn't know what's happening to her. And I think the importance of memory and the soul and the intellect, although it doesn't completely define the person, it's somehow critical for the person. And we must never forget that point either. We recognize that to some extent. Death is now defined not by the EKG, but by the EEG, not by cardiac function, but cerebral function. This is a procedural thing. I don't think it's extremely deep, but it is a tacit acknowledgement, even if the doctor in question is an atheist or an agnostic, that the soul and personhood matter, that the person is not merely a machine with a cardiac pump that can get bunged up. And so I think when we think about metaphysics, we need to include science. The metaphysics should not be a metaphysics of the gap, playing on the term God of the gap, coined by the theologian Henry Drummond in defending science. And I will close with this quote from Dietrich Bonhoeffer. This is a letter he wrote from a Nazi prison. How wrong it is to use God as a stopgap for the incompleteness of our knowledge. If, in fact, the frontiers of knowledge are being pushed further and further back, and that is bound to be the case, then God is being pushed back with them in a metaphysics or God of the gaps, and is therefore continually in the retreat. In retreat, we are to find God in what we know, not in what we don't know. Thank you.
We need the Elan Vital that you started off with, and sort of this notion of vitalism. Was there a physical mechanism that he was trying to associate with that, or was that something that was attributed to him by others?
Okay, this was sort of the Cliff Notes version of Bergson, but he was playing off of Einstein's theory of time. He actually started out life as a mathematician. And one of his famous students, by the way, was Marcel Proust. Marcel Proust did a PhD in philosophy with Henri Bergson, very concerned with time. His novel is In Search of Lost Time. So he was playing off Einstein's theory of time. He says that time is not a constant. He had a very complicated theory of duration. And he thought that Elan Vital was something that operated within the context of this complex notion of time that drives evolution. So there are, although he was a philosopher, it's not always clear what he's driving at. It's kind of a gold mine that we should all dig into very much.
Do you think of
Heilomorphism
as a kind of vitalism?
No.
No.
Like,
no.
The other question.
Yes, if Dr. Meredith thinks of Heilomorphism as a form of vitalism.
No, I don't. But I think I was talking about the objections to the idea of Elan Vital are that it's not a real force. So someone like Julian Huxley says it's not a real force. It doesn't explain anything more than Elan Lokomotiv explains about the locomotive. What I think he meant by that was he was thinking, as a scientist, he was thinking exclusively in terms of efficient and material cause. And in that case, no, it does not. Elan Vital doesn't necessarily explain anything. But if you think of it as some, perhaps a formal cause, maybe that has more explanatory power.
So when you were speaking at the end about him joining us to keep in mind the human face of disease like Alzheimer's, you switched between talking about like a loss of memory and a loss of personhood,
right?
Is like very, very natural.
So I was speaking quickly, but I think the loss of memory, I think, if I can put it this way, the subjective experiential sense that an old patient with Alzheimer's disease has is of losing their own personhood.
Yeah.
Okay. And I don't think they actually cease to be persons, all right, because the mind is, you know, as our last speaker said, we are not just our minds, we're more than that, but our minds have a lot to do with it. And I think from the inside, in the existential sense, people with Alzheimer's disease have a sense of losing personhood. They also get treated less like people, I think, is the other thing.
So my question, just to finish, was given that you don't like that, you think that the EKG versus EEG criterion for death is mostly a procedural one. And given that much of the memory stuff is going to be physically encoded, I was curious if you have any thoughts on
I do. I mean, it's a big problem precisely because, you know, doctors, why do things, you know, the medical ethicist I know, Jeff Bishop, he gets very irritated at medical ethics because it's so procedural. And I agree with him. But, so it's very annoying. It's not very deep philosophically. But there's a reason it gets procedural, because doctors have to deal with patients. There's a real patient here, and so they have to do something. But I think while we have to do procedures, ethical as well as other, we also have to bear in mind the shortcomings of that of that approach. And I think EEG, it's probably, I mean, I don't really disagree with the shift from EKG to EEG, but we have to realize that that's just a procedure too. It doesn't say everything.
If I could just ask one clarifying question. So you mentioned that Thomas states that there isn't a corporeal organ in spinal.
Right.
And as such, like none of the powers that are proper in the intellect correspond to any corporeal
right.
organ.
Right.
Do you see that as a sort of like God of the Gaps explanation?
No, but it's not a very clear explanation. If you read what his argument is in the Summa at least, but he also says similar things elsewhere, that the intellect can perceive universals. And if the intellect had a bodily component, it wouldn't be able to see bodies. And he makes a couple of physical analogies. A bitter tongue, the bitter tongue of the patient, everything would taste bitter. If you look through a colored vase, everything would look like that color. He makes arguments like that. I think they're not very good arguments, to be honest. I hate to say that about Thomas Aquinas, after all, but there have been card-carrying Thomists who have taken Thomas to task for those arguments. I think it's a very problematical argument. I mean, I think the best thing you can say about it is that what he's making there is not a statement so much about the brain as about what knowledge and the intellect are, that these are incorporeal. Anyway, that's my thought. I don't know if I've clarified this.
Let's take Dr. Meredith one more time.